Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and I am here today with my Bruegel colleagues, the Auto Gang, to talk about electric vehicles, Chinese overcapacity, and what Europe can do about it. I am joined today by Antoine Mathieu-Collin, Ugna Kelyaskaita, and Ben McWilliams. They are part of a group that is doing some really interesting work on this based on our clean tech tracker, which you can find on our website. And Ugna, tell us what this project is about and what you're finding.
Thank you very much, Rebecca. Also, thank you for having us today. Let me start by saying why this matters for Europe now. So Europe's automotive industry is navigating two simultaneous transitions at the same time. And it is the interaction between the two that makes the current moment so difficult, but also interesting from the policy perspective. So first, Europe is committed to a green transition, which also includes decarbonizing transport sector. So passenger cars account for more than half of emissions in EU transport sector, and the transport sector itself accounts for nearly a third of EU greenhouse gas emissions. And unlike other sectors, road transport emissions have stubbornly resisted decline. But for me, green transition at the same time is a question for energy security and also affordability. Since the last energy crisis in 2022, the EU has sharply and quickly reduced reliance on Russian energy when it comes to gas, oil, and coal, but it has not solved the dependency on fossil fuels. And the conflict in Iran has made this vulnerability very difficult to ignore. So in March 2026, the Strait of Hormuz, through which a quarter of world seaborne oil passes, was effectively closed. And even though only a small part of that oil goes directly to Europe, when Asian buyers are cut off from the supplies, they compete for the same flexible supply as Europe. And as a result, this pushes up global oil prices. So when a global fossil fuel energy market tightens, Europe pays more. So to avoid this, Europe should transition to a system that is based on domestic energy generation. And for Europe specifically, that means electrification that is powered by renewable generation. And EU has made significant progress in that. The share of renewables in electricity generation has increased from around 37% in 2021 to 48% in 2025. But the problem is the share of electricity in the final energy demand. It has been stuck at 23% since 2011. And in transport specifically, this is the lowest share among all sectors, just 2%. So a rapid shift to electric vehicles allows for a cut in emissions from the sector that is most resistant to change. And at the same time, it reduces Europe's exposure to volatile fossil fuel markets. And the second transition is competitive. So Europe's automotive sector is one of the most important industries. It's a major source of jobs, of exports, and economic spillovers. And it's being hit by a double shock. While the car makers are making this transition of switching from making internal combustion engines to EVs. So first of all, at home in the EU, Chinese competition is intensifying. So China has built dominance in batteries and also the raw materials that go into them. So they're investing at a scale that allows their firms to produce at prices that European manufacturers cannot currently match. To give you some numbers, by 2024, over 70% of EU clean technology imports came from China, and this included 60% of EVs. And also with the US market largely close to Chinese exports through tariffs, Chinese goods are redirected into Europe, which remains so more open than the US. So European manufacturers are being undercut on price in their own markets. And I mentioned the double shock. So the second effect is that abroad, a key market is closing. So the US has been a growing destination for European-made electric vehicles. That was supported by Inflation Reduction Act provisions that made EU exports commercially viable. But the one big beautiful bill that was passed in August 2025 phased out EV tax credits, and it's estimated to result in around 35 million fewer EV sales, 2035, which is a 25% reduction. So the question is not whether Europe should act in the space of EV policy, but it's how to act in a way that is cost efficient, so that gives industry this breathing space to adjust without shielding it permanently from competition, and also that keeps the energy transition on track rather than making it more expensive.
Thanks for that. So we have China and the US handing out subsidies. We have a European industry that needs a push, but that we also don't want to shield from needing to be competitive. Ben, what are you finding and what do we make of it all?
Yeah. So the starting point where we are is that today about 2 in 10 new cars sold are electric. And if we look at this from the consumer perspective, where Europe wants to go is that by 2035, 9 out of 10, or it used to be 10 out of 10. Now the commission has proposed weakening that to 9 out of 10 new cars sold should be electric. So that's kind of the game that the automobile industry is playing and needs to achieve. And as Ugnar illustrates, the big question there is essentially, I mean, you can call it international competition, but it's Chinese competition. European car makers are still very competitive in fossil vehicles and, to be honest, still pretty competitive in electric vehicles. If you walk down the road in any European country, you start seeing a few BYDs and other Chinese brands, but it's not that we're flooded with BYDs. You still see more Volkswagens, more Skodas, more Renault electric vehicles than BYDs. So, European car makers are still in a strong position. It's difficult. This is a century-old supply chain that's being torn up and redesigned, and putting a battery in a vehicle rather than all the different parts of a combustion engine is fundamentally different. That's somewhere where Chinese companies really have an advantage, is on battery manufacturing and the battery supply chain. And, as we see it, and kind of it's been a few months now, it's been even a few years that we've been thinking about this question, and a few months, particularly this piece, that's kind of where we're arriving. And I think that's also where the European Commission is arriving, is we need the framework in place to guide the automotive industry towards an electric future. I mean, it's toward a zero emission future. People often say, oh, should be technology neutral. It is technology neutral. It's just that there's no other technology. I mean, we tried hydrogen cars, other things, but electric vehicles are the only solution that has scaled that doesn't have emissions at the tailpipe. And then the question is getting there, and what do you do about China? And how do you basically, on the one hand, embrace it? Because it's truly amazing that Chinese companies have made these innovations and driven down the cost of batteries so far, and they produce competitive electric vehicles, and that 1 in 2 new cars in China are electric. It's incredible news for the world's climate. And it's also incredible news for European consumers to have this new source of EVs and competitive EVs. On the other hand, you cannot be naive, and it's not that you can just let Chinese vehicles come in and take the whole market. So how do you kind of strike that balance and kind of essentially, I think, arrive at a compromise with China where part of the market, we accept that. I think Chinese EVs will definitely take some share of the market. Exactly what that number is a question for market dynamics and a bit of policy. And how do you embrace that whilst at the same time ensuring that European companies are competitive in this space? But I think, as you said at the beginning of Rebecca, not overprotected. And I think that's the dangerous line when you start, because automotive companies are among the most heavily subsidized companies already in Europe. They receive enormous subsidies because they have so many jobs. So they have a really big power, lobbying power. I think they have the speed dial of prime ministers, the CEOs of automotive companies. And how do you strike that balance between maintaining competitive pressures, accepting Chinese competition, and still having good industry in Europe, I think is the challenge that we see and we policymakers need to work on.
And Antoine, what are the policy recommendations that are coming out of this, particularly for this really European champion industry, as Ben was just saying?
Yes, indeed. So in short, we have industrial issue, we have business issue, and on top of that, a lot of it is driven by policy choices. So we mentioned the policy choices by the US, the one from China, and also in the EU, because we have this 19% tailpipe emission reduction target. And if it was not enough, then you can add also the crisis in Iran, maybe some dependency vis-a-vis China, and then the political implication, because all the jobs are held by people who vote in the election. So this is quite complex. So in terms of policy, it looks like the EU has 3 different objectives to square. So the first one is decarbonization. The second one is competitiveness. And then when we think about competitiveness, it's not only on our own market, but also on third countries' markets. So the EV industry is built on exports. Volkswagen, Stellantis, and all those companies, they use to make a huge margin in China, in South America. So it is important to have in mind that not only the prices in our market, but also in the world's market. The third one is resilience, or as we the EU jargon will be economic security. So you have three different objectives that you have to choose from. So there are some trade-offs, there are some distributional effects. So we may wonder whether it is an incompatibility triangle or not. But the starting position is, at the moment, we are electrifying via cheap EVs, which are both locally produced, but also imported from China. And when they are locally produced, they also rely on low-cost batteries and raw materials from China. So this is good for decarbonization because we can go quick. We can use the technology and the cost advantage by China. But at the same time, it depends dependence on it leaves the entire EV sectors exposed to supply chain. So geopolitical risk, logistical risk, and so on and so forth. So this is what the commission and the national government have seen. So what they are trying to do is at the same time to shield domestic supply chain and to keep production costs a bit low. You do it by delaying a bit decarbonization target. So, and also to help the ICE platform, so this is the incumbent in a way. But at the same time, if you do it, for instance, with local content requirement, we have seen in the new Industrial Accelerator Act, there is a risk that European automakers will lose competitiveness in the long run because it will make it harder to export affordable, high-quality vehicles. So we have seen in this space a flurry, I would say, of proposals by the Commission in all areas. So there was a strategic dialogue with the industry that leads to the Automotive Action Plan. So a lot of financing have been promised. We have seen the battery booster, the decarbonization of corporate fleets, the next MFF and the Competitiveness Fund also promise some funding, which is still to be defined. We have on the stated field, of course, several IPCs, which are linked to batteries more for research. So in a way, we have a bit more four big pillars of the policy in this area. We have one which is financing, then we have a lot of deregulation or ease of climate regulation burden, I must say. We mentioned the CO2 standards already. There are some stuff to help small affordable cars where you will have less stringent regulation in terms of, for instance, of safety or all the things that you need to have in your car. You have the defensive part of it, some kind of defensive shield. So this is the made in EU or made with EU requirements that are there. Maybe some conditionality will be put on Chinese FDIs. You have, of course, the anti-subsidy investigation. So the commission found that China was over-subsidizing a few companies and because of it imposed countervailing duties, so import duties. And then there are the fourth dimension, which is opening up new markets. So with new FTAs with Mercosur, India, Indonesia, and some CTIP, Clean Trade Investment Partnership, for instance, South Africa. The idea is to open up all markets. So it is a pretty messy political landscape. And when we look at what is there, we don't see a lot of simplification. We also are a bit unclear about what is the actual strategy. But it is clear that, as I said in the introduction, so we have to balance a bit the different objectives. We have to balance to navigate the two transitions, transition away from fossil fuels and transitioning away from unhealthy dependencies. And for this, our thinking is we need to actually raise demand, for instance, via infrastructure charging to make sure that people actually want to buy those cars. Fair transition is a very important point that Tugne made as well. So if there is subsidies maybe for some kind of household which are financially constrained, simplification and again shield, this is fine, but not to verge too much on isolationism.
Thanks for that. In the next part of our podcast, I want to talk a little more about how we came to these conclusions. Ben, can you tell us about the Clean Tech Tracker project and how we got to where we are now and how you chose this to focus on? I mean, I guess it's very much a topic of the moment, so it's in the policy agenda. But also, I feel like the data is pushing us to take a deeper look at this.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks, Rebecca. It's a couple of years now that we've worked on this Clean Tech Tracker project. Ironically, I guess we got the push from the last energy crisis when we did a lot of data work on particularly on natural gas, and we kind of realized that there was a space for this and we could deliver something helpful to people in Brussels, but also around Europe and around the world in terms of translating some of the complex data out there into more readable information. And what we took away there was that, yeah, we'd like to do the same thing in the clean tech space. And what we have now been doing for a couple of years is trying to pull together the best available data we can find across the space on different clean technologies for the installation of clean technologies, the manufacture, trade, employment. And we do this for about 8 technologies, one of which is electric vehicles. And as you say, electric vehicles is perhaps one of the most interesting ones. We track investments, we track manufacturing investments, and you see that electric vehicles and batteries completely dominate manufacturing investments in Europe, but also globally. We often talk about the need for clean, green manufacturing investments, and you'll see long lists of technologies to invest in. And of course, it's nice to invest in many technologies, and it's not just the investment volume that matters, but it is about 80% of the global investment into clean tech are batteries and electric vehicles. So it's really, for us, the obvious place where to look. And then the trade numbers and elsewhere are also what makes this interesting, because it's, again, on trade, it dominates. I mean, you talk about clean tech trade and Europe having some pretty healthy exports actually in clean tech trade, they're all electric vehicles. So to us, that really makes sense. And that's why it's the sector that we wanted to do a deep dive into, as we are.
Thanks for that. Well, now you were talking a lot about the geopolitical context for this, and I'd like to come back to you on European demand for these electric vehicles, because we certainly have seen with the war in Iran and the fossil fuel price hikes that there's a lot of uncertainty there. But also, Europeans aren't yet making the shift to electric cars really en masse. So can you give us some context there?
I think when it comes to demand, it's important to touch on another policy instrument. It's the Emissions Trading Scheme version 2. This is the extension of carbon pricing to roads and transport sector, which has been delayed from 2027 to 2028. So when it comes into force, it will put a price on petrol and diesel, and this would in turn make the electric vehicles relatively more competitive compared to internal combustion engines. And what is very important from this scheme, that the carbon revenues will be recycled to support households in green transition. And I think here where the demand could be leveraged. So we know that the problem with electric cars is that initially it has high investment costs, but over time people make up for it by saving. And through those revenues, governments could help households to make that initial investment. What is important here, that only 5 member states so far have submitted social climate funds that is required to access the part of those revenues that will be front-loaded 1 year in advance. To do so, they need to submit social climate plans. And it is a problem because only 5 countries so far have submitted it. It means that countries might miss on the opportunity to take advantage of this. There is one good example specific for this case. It is Sweden. It has adopted its plan, and they plan to use that revenue entirely for electric vehicles, so to support low and middle income households. So I think it's important to provide schemes that would allow consumers to make advantage and to purchase electric vehicles.
How much of this goes for buying European-made electric vehicles as opposed to either an internationally-made electric vehicle or just infrastructure? So you've already got a car and now you need to put a charging station in your garage or extra ones in your neighborhood. Like, how do they divide all that up?
It's a good question. I think it depends on a specific member state. So the decision is theirs. So what we see from major markets, for example, Germany, it launched a new scheme. It's roughly 3 billion euros. It starts in 2026 and it will be open to all manufacturers. It includes Chinese brands with subsidies up to 6,000, targeting low and middle income households. But in contrast, you have examples in Spain and France that require local content requirements, so this made in Europe provision. So for France, you can get the subsidy for EU assembled car, and you have an additional bonus for a vehicle that has European made batteries.
Interesting. Antoine, what's your take on buy European?
So there have been quite some movement on this front. The first piece of legislation to start mingling with it was the Net Zero Industry Act. So the Net Zero Industry Act has some article which impose for public procurement auction, but therefore electric vehicles were interested in consumer-facing schemes. So to have those schemes, the one that Ugne just mentioned, to for instance buy a new EV, to have it conditional to sustainability and resilience conditions. So in practice, depending on how you make this criteria, and this is for the member state authorities to do it, you can have a very similar effect. But the Net Zero Industry Act, this Article 28, is just entering into force. So it's a bit too early actually to see whether it has any effect. But what is true is that France and Spain and other countries are very much pushing for it, and they believe that it is not enough. And in the Commission new proposal for an Industrial Accelerator Act, this is made a bit stronger, not only with sustainability and resilience condition, but on top of them with a Made in EU requirement. So if the bill is passed as it is, then member states would be required to award such bonuses only for made in EU cars or with made in EU components like the batteries. By the way, it is the case for automotive, but also for other clean tech technologies such as solar panels, wind turbines, and so on and so forth. It is interesting to see what is the actual benefit of it. So the proponent of the bill say that is a way to give a briefing space to the industry and at the same time to make sure that the EU or national money which is given for those consumer schemes actually benefits the EU manufacturers. This is a good point. At the same time, the effect of it is to exclude foreign and in particular Chinese competitors from selling cars in the EU. This is a bit damaging because we would cut ourselves from first the spur of competition that will incentivize the EU manufacturing to make better cars because they are competing for consumers on price and choice, but also cheap EVs that allow us to decarbonize quickly and also have a very low price, which is also important for affordability and for low-income households. So all in all, so we'll see what happened in the Council and the Parliament. It's clear that we have more or less a very big push by a few member states and a few, I would say, right-wing parties to for this Made in EU thing. And at the same time, you also more liberal free traders, countries and parties which are more pragmatic and would like to see us speedy decarbonization, even if it's at the cost of more Chinese imports.
Super interesting. And there's a couple things I want to ask about. One is you compared it to solar panels, and the solar panel situation is one where Europe has mostly conceded that China is now going to make them and that European value added needs to be on installation and integration and things like that. Are we approaching a similar point on car batteries, or are we earlier in the cycle or in a different place in the cycle? How does that look?
So indeed, this comparison is made all the time, including by the proponent of the bill. So the first important thing is, so now the Industrial Accelerator Act will suggest that you have subsidies only if you install a European solar panel with some European component in, like the inverter on some other photovoltaic cells. And indeed, this is the things. The idea is to avoid being in such a situation that all the production comes to China and we just import it. We have some requirement. Whether this is sufficient or this is a good idea is something a bit different.
Clarify, I think, as you characterized, Rebecca, is how most people think. But the European Commission, or at least DG GROW, has a slightly different opinion, because if you look into the Industrial Accelerator Act, that proposes that the solar cells are still manufactured in Europe. And that's part that nothing happens in Europe today. That I mean, they have an estimate, I think that would about double the price of solar manufactured. So I mean, end of this years long debate of why it makes sense to do protectionism on the solar industry, and I don't think it does. It raises electricity prices, which hurts all other industries in Europe, and it's a highly commoditized system, solar, and the ability to import cheap solar Chinese panels is really a blessing that reduces our fossil fuel dependence, and one that I think we should be exploiting. They also discussed the solar inverters, which I think is something that can make sense, where Europe has a lot of competitiveness, and also if you look and listen to the kind of cybersecurity experts, that's the part of the panel that they'll tell you is the risk. At the moment, the proposal is to do both solar cells and inverters. And in my opinion, at least, just doing the inverters is really what matters and what should be the focus.
That leads really nicely into the other thing I wanted to ask about next, which is the supply chain. What parts of the supply chain do you think are most important for Europe? And how do we square that with the policies that are coming down?
It's hard because it really depends what your priorities are. Typically, these supply chains go from high energy consumption and high capital consumption at the beginning towards a little bit more labor and high skills at the end. So if you're doing industrial policy because you want to create potentially European jobs, if you believe that industrial policy can create jobs, that you want to create well-paying jobs in Europe, then it would make sense to focus on the end of the supply chains. And that's also a lot more cost effective because the earlier stages are where China has a huge advantage, and you just need enormous spaces of land and energy consumption. Now, if it's about economic security, then you don't really create that much benefit by just having the end of the supply chain, because you still rely on importing earlier parts of the supply chain. So if that's really what you care about, then you kind of have to try and do the whole value chain, which is very hard. I think an approach of trying to have some of the later stages in Europe with high skills, and then looking to the global market. So trying to not say we reshore everything, but at least we don't have such a high import dependence from China. For example, India is making a lot of investments these days, and is one market that Europe could look at for some of these earlier supply chain stages. So you have to have a bit of a nuance there. And I think there's no one size fits all answer. And that's what makes this very interesting and tricky, these proposals coming out of the European Commission, this idea of kind of doing industrial policy at big scale in Europe again, is the need to get into the weeds of these supply chains and kind of make value trade-offs right along the supply chain. And there's not, as I say, there's no one-size-fits-all answer for every value chain. I think you have to look on a case-by-case basis.
And Antoine, what about state aid? This is something where the EU has had different focus over the years. Sometimes there's really been an emphasis on making sure that countries don't get internally subsidized and outcompeted by their European peers. And sometimes there's more of a sense of we really need more European competitiveness in the outside world. And that means allowing countries with deeper pocketbooks to spend a little bit more internally. How do we fit that against what we've got today?
I think it's an interesting and very difficult question. I think to recall the basis, I think in the EU, we are the only jurisdiction where we control tightly stated spending, because we want to avoid races to the bottom, subsidy races and things like this. We also believe that giving a subsidy changes competition and therefore can have harmful effect that can, in certain cases, be more important than the just added effect of the subsidy. This is not something that exists in China. This is not what things that exist in the US. So, for instance, in the US, you all know that many companies will just move to Delaware because of fiscal reasons, right? And the state control, the EU, is precisely there to avoid that. Not only that some of the deeper pocket countries can outspend the others, but also that companies will go do forum shopping on fish for the more aid, decide on their location based on it. So, in one hand, that it also constrains us a bit, because we cannot give as much subsidies than the other jurisdiction, like China and the US. On the other hand, maybe we should not. And it also, as a byproduct, something which is more linked to efficiency, because you have to justify why you give aid, what is the added value of the aid. And it's not only because you have good relation with the government that you will receive subsidies, but because you have a project that will create some added value and has not so much negative consequences on the entire value chain. So that's the thing. Then, of course, as you said, there was a lot of different changes in approach over the years. So in the 1980s, 1990s, we had a lot of a big corporation, often linked to the states, that would receive money on those. Corporation was not necessarily very efficient. And over the years, the idea that we need to reduce the amount of aid to have more competition was successful. And then now we have to adapt a bit, mostly because, as you mentioned, other jurisdictions, China, the US, are using a lot this tool. But at the same time, we need to preserve the principle. So the equilibrium which has been found in the temporary crisis framework and then the new Clean Industrial Deal stated framework is to allow generally more aid, but make it available to all companies that have good projects. So companies are a bit competing for aid in a way. At the same time, if you have risk of showing some of the activities and you can prove that as a company that in another jurisdiction you will receive more aid, then you have some kind of nuclear weapon in the stated law that allows you to match this amount of aid based on solid evidence. So I would say that we, as has been said, those companies receive generally a large amount of subsidies. We have stated is also not sufficient to be competitive. We have seen with the case of Norvolt, which secured a huge amount of funding, that it is not a substitute for good good business case. It's not substitute for having demand for your product, having a superior product to the others, but it's a tool that can help. We have seen, for instance, in some industrial areas, I will think about the north of France, where we have seen a lot of batteries by French companies, but also South Korean companies, Chinese companies. And this is a new geography which has been built not only on the back of subsidies, but because you have comparative advantage to be in a specific region. So stated yes, but it's not sufficient. I think where to invest in the value chain has to be with the identification of comparative advantage and where we will have the best value for money.
And maybe if I can add, I think it's also quite important to have a conversation who pays for the industry protection, maybe in general, because those costs exist regardless how they are framed and they have to be paid by someone. So if we raise tariffs on cheap Chinese electric vehicles, consumers have to pay more for a car. If we introduce local content requirements that perhaps push up production costs, taxpayers fund the difference through subsidy schemes. And if we shield European manufacturers from competition too much, we reduce the pressure to cut costs and innovate. And consumers pay that price too, just in the long run. And there might be arguments for that redistribution. So protecting strategic industries, reducing dependence on China, or keeping jobs in Europe. And these are all legitimate goals. But I think we need to be explicit about the price tag. It's important not to treat this industrial protection as if it's free, because it's actually not. And also there's a second cause that really rarely gets mentioned, is that every policy that makes electric vehicles more expensive, it slows down the transition. So fewer people buy the EVs, more petrol cars stay on the roads, more oil gets imported. There is a cost in emissions, there is the cost in energy security, and Hormuz disruption, it reminded how expensive it could be for Europe specifically.
So what about the balance that we need to keep between bigger countries and countries that are smaller or that don't have budget space or otherwise might feel that they're at a disadvantage if we open the aid spigots?
So I think in Europe, we have two main safeguards against it, which work to a certain extent. The first one I mentioned it already is the stated control framework, let's say. And the second one is also all the EU money which goes to cohesion. And some of this funding is used for the automotive sector. So that also gives, when you look at the actual data, some result that you may not expect based on what we know about big and small countries, rich on poor countries, and on fiscal spaces. For instance, Hungary is one who subsidize a lot the automotive industry, not necessarily the big ones, but also the entire supply chain, and not only European car makers, but also some Chinese OEM. So this is important to have in mind, so that each country is trying to see where it does advantages for what exactly on building on it. I think the Netherlands example with ASML or some other semiconductors companies is interesting. So each one is trying to find a smart way to have good value for money. And I think it's quite interesting not to have only a European strategy, but some national or even regional strategy that try to maximize to make the best with the resources we have.
Thanks. In the last part of our podcast, I'd like to talk specifically about coming up with a strategy to deal with Chinese exports. You all have said that there are ways to work either through negotiations and work with China to come up with quotas or some sort of balance, and also things that the EU can do on its own. So walk us through what you're looking at and what your recommendations are. You've touched on some of them earlier, but I think it's worth spending a little more time on them.
I can give it a first stab, and then Antoine and Ogunia will add. To recap the China discussion, we began about 18 months ago with the imposition of tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles after the Commission found unfair trading practices. Starting point is those tariffs only cover pure battery electric vehicles, and they don't cover plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. So you have this quite perverse thing where as battery electric vehicles, pure battery vehicles from China have dropped, plug-in hybrids have increased because there's no tariff, with the downside that the emissions is much worse of plug-in hybrids. That's first kind of, well, not really an aside, it's very important, but that should be addressed. Anyway, these tariffs are now, the current proposal is that these tariffs will shift to what's called the minimum price undertaking. So the idea that for each vehicle, there'd be a negotiation and a price would be set, and you cannot send the vehicle into the EU for less than that price. Why is that happening? Well, that's happening because a lot of European companies are the ones sending the vehicles from China into the EU. So putting tariffs on these Chinese, so-called Chinese companies, turns out particularly Volkswagen was knocking on the door in the Berlin month saying, hey, what about our cars, which we want to export back into the EU? And hence, there's now the proposal to shift to a minimum price undertaking. I think so far that's only been agreed for one car, a Cupra from Volkswagen. The idea would now be over the coming year that more brands and more models could negotiate these minimum price undertakings directly with the European Commission. I think there's also things in there about investment. So you would negotiate minimum price undertaking, and you might also make some commitments on your investments in Europe, because it's about striking that balance between allowing some Chinese imported vehicles in and encouraging joint ventures, particularly and investments into Europe to manufacture in Europe as well. So that's a bit where we are today. One idea that we will explore in the piece is the idea which the route Canada has gone down, which is that basically you give an export quota or an import quota, depending which way you look at it, to China. Perhaps you determine it by brand, or as I guess suppose you let China administrate it, but that basically you say, look, I don't know, about 80,000 a month, would it be something around here? Let's say 10% of the market or something. And you basically say to Chinese companies, again, Chinese companies, including European companies who operate in China, that's the share of the market you can have. You're free to compete there, and you close that off. And at least for simplicity reasons, it definitely has some attractiveness. And I think in terms of giving long signals for the market, it could be a smart approach. As always, of course, settling on a policy and sticking to it is the most attractive thing for businesses. It's always easy to say. And this kind of flip-flopping around is not great, but I also understand it because it's a very tricky policy question. And I think the commission is working through. So I think some combination of these and arriving at a point where essentially you let a certain share of the market open to competition for imports from China. You try to have that share of the market at competitive price, so that it benefits European consumers. And at the same time, you create the right market signals that investment, manufacturing investment continues to flow from China into Europe. Good manufacturing investment, creating European jobs, and equally the European investment is coming into Europe. I think that's the challenge, and that's where we're trying to arrive at as Europe.
Now, Antoine, would either of you like to add something to this?
I think the clean tech tracker that we launched at Bruegel is a very nice data set where you can track the development in this space, because we track the manufacturing facilities and EV vehicle assembly online, and we can also see where the investment comes from. So it's interesting to see how the industrial landscape will change over time, whether the new factories or the joint ventures with the Chinese will be located at roughly the places where the historic manufacturers were, or whether it will move to other places and maybe the industrial landscape will change. So I encourage the listeners to have a look at the platform online.
Yeah, I think we discussed a lot about what we can do on all sides. So there is the trade instrument that mentioned by Ben. Then we have two different sorts of things. On the industrial policy side, you have the Made in EU, and you have also the FDI things. So first, we need to make clear what is our strategy there and how we reconcile trade policy and industrial policy. So because there are some weird, let's say, overlap, and we have to be consistent. And then to decide also how to deal with China in the sense that China has an involution problem, meaning that we have aggressive state-led industrial policy in clean tech sector, that including EV, that led to intense competition between the manufacturers in China, each one ramping up quickly the production thanks to large subsidies and also abundant funding, but that creates price wars, declining profit margins, and the less performing firms are not exiting the markets, so that nourish some kind of downward spiral. So because of it, the domestic market in China is overcrowded. So they have to export their cars and their other clean tech products, including to the EU, because it's the only pathway to overcome their overcapacities. And this is a problem not only for the Chinese government as such, but for each and every firm in China that is trying to make profits in this environment. And so the trade restrictions that we have, they have effect, but the tariff and the countervailing duties, they can slow down, but they can erase entirely this dynamic. And we of course have an interest to strengthen this dynamic, but also China as a government, but also as companies. So they also need to access our enormous market, all the more since the one in the US is becoming closed. So there is probably some ground to discuss directly with China, to whether it is in the for price undertaking or wider agreement.
Are there any big misconceptions that you all think we should address, or things you wish people knew about this market?
I guess I have one, which Ugne already touched on, which is that we often talk about the risk of Chinese import dependence for EVs, and we either forget or we equate it with the fossil fuel import dependence, and kind of forget to do that math in our head that an EV imported from China, once it's on the road, is there and is consuming electricity produced domestically. And that's compared to 20 years of importing barrels of oil, which is a far greater and more dangerous dependence. And I heard a nice way of framing, not really a nice way, a scary way of framing the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, what this means. At the moment, there's still drawdown of strategic reserves. There was some floating Russian oil, and we're not really yet seeing the impact of what the closure of the strait means, in spite of the price of diesel being above €2 per litre in many countries, petrol €1.80. It's something like 10 to 12 million barrels a day that comes through the Strait of Hormuz. And the way that it was explained and it is striking is the demand destruction that the world will need to go through if the strait remains closed is the same as what we saw in March 2020. So it's the same as the COVID lockdown. And that won't be because your company tells you to stay at home and governments say to stay at home. That will just be prices. So the price of diesel, the price of gasoline, the price of kerosene will have to get to the point to make the world act as if we're back in lockdown. But yeah, very rough back of envelope. That's a little bit the price impact that we're looking at. And you hear the analysts talking about prices going far higher than they are today. And I just think that really drives home the point of when we think of economic security and we think of these import dependencies, that there's really nothing comparable to what we've now lived to for half a century since the 1970s in fossil fuel, but particularly oil import dependencies. And the great thing about EVs, besides the climate benefits, besides the fact that they will be more affordable for consumers once they're scaled up and infrastructure is in place, is that you reduce this oil import dependence, which particularly for Europe, who doesn't produce much oil at all, would also be a great thing for the trade balance. I think that's something that people know it, but maybe we don't hear it enough.
That's a big change, because we've been comparing it to 2022 when Russia invaded Ukraine and there was a more temporary energy shock. But looking back to 2020 and the COVID lockdowns, which were much more invasive across the economy and which lasted longer, is a real shifting of perspective. Ugne, Antoine, anything you want to add here?
I couldn't agree more with Ben. I think that it's important to think about the EVs or solar panels in a way that once it's installed, it's there, it's free. No one can sanction European sunlight or close a strait to prevent wind from blowing. And I think it's also important to think about the crisis, which highlight the cost of this vulnerability to fossil fuels, and for Europe to be more proactive rather than reactive when it comes to these crises. So the more we can electrify, the more we push on the EVs, the less exposed to future shocks Europe will be.
We have not been very proactive, but we can also be reactive now. So I think there's nothing better than a big crisis and a huge price spike to change our habits. So in COVID, I think we digitalized and at a speed that no one expected. With the invasion of Ukraine, we switched away from Russian fuel at a speed also that was unmatched. So today, maybe we have a good price tag, on good incentive to move away from oil in transport very quickly. So it's a bit more positive tone, I would say.
Well, thanks so much for that. You've been listening to The Sound of Economics with Bruegel's automotive gang, represented by Ben McWilliams, Ugne Kelioskaite, and Antoine Mathieu Collin. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. You can find links to the Clean Tech Tracker and a lot of our related research in the show notes here, all for free on our website, Bruegel.org. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.